two schools of thought, all right? One, which is by Newton, is that if I have some candle and I have some light, and let's say I have somebody's eye here, okay? This light is just a series of particles. Light are, it's corpuscular, as we call it, meaning it's small little bodies. It's essentially an atomic theory of light. And these objects just, you know, he's thinking in terms of this mechanistic idea. It's just like we think of matter with atoms. These are just little billiard balls and balls, and they get emitted from this light, and they just travel a straight path to your eye, and there you go. Okay? So this is the corpuscular idea. It's basically a particle idea on what light is. So this is Newton. This is Newton's fault, because he was wrong. But, okay. Now, there's another guy named Huygens. And what he thought was happening, and now, you know, we've talked about it enough. You see that he was along the lines of how we think, is that you actually have waves here getting emitted. All right? And these waves propagate through space. Now, he didn't know anything about Maxwell's equations. This was, you know, hundreds of years ago, 300 years ago. But he thought, well, you know, light could be a wave. And he went and described it this way and tried to come up with a perspective where the phenomena that we observe with light could be explained. Okay? Now, I will talk about that a little bit later. The interesting thing is that, of course, Maxwell chimes in and says, yes, it's a wave. That's what we've just been spending the last couple lectures on. But, as we will see at the very end of the class, I hope, in quantum mechanics, which sort of threw down all of the classical physics ideas, we actually see a resurrection of the idea of light as a particle. We use the word letter gamma, Greek letter gamma, to designate it. When I used the word photon earlier, I was referring to what we think of in quantum mechanics as a particle of light, a photon. But it turns out that in quantum mechanics, light is both a particle and a wave. So, and in fact, in classical physics, this sort of odd phenomena where we're trying to think of this in these two different cases has to happen. So we're going to spend more time now this week thinking of light as a particle, but then ultimately we're going to go back to it as a wave. And you see that these things are almost seem contradictory, but in fact they're complementary ways of looking at what light is. It's not quite fair to call it just a wave or just a particle. Okay? It depends on what you're doing. But let's, as I said, we're going to take the approximation that Newton started, which was that light is a particle. So this forms the field of geometrical optics. And in this case, if I have a wave that's propagating in time or in space, then we simplify that as a ray, which is in the direction of transport of that wave. Okay? So we're ignoring the fact that there's an E field and a B field oscillating up and down or side to side. We just think about this as a ray. Not even quite a particle, okay, but a ray. So geometric optics then becomes very geometrical. We start just having geometrical shapes defined by the passage of these rays. Until they hit something, they're a straight line, for instance. All right. Let me just mention the first case of this. When we have a mirror, and this was actually something that was known to the Greeks, to Euclid. If we have light, let's say I have a flashlight here, and I emit light, if I emit light such that it is perpendicular to the surface of the mirror, okay, then what's going to happen is there's going to be reflected light, and that reflected light is going to come back along the path of the incident light. Okay? If I emit light at an angle, then it turns out I can define this angle with respect to the perpendicular to the surface. We'll call this angle theta. Then it turns out that there will be some angle of reflection, and let's call this theta prime, that when we have a mirror, and this is just from conservation of momentum, if we think of this as a little billiard ball traveling, it has some momentum P in this direction. And that momentum has to be conserved. And so what happens is, when it hits this, it will come back, and we find that what we expect to happen is that theta prime equals theta. So the angle of incidence, theta, is equal to the angle of reflection, theta prime. Okay, this is called the law of reflection. And this law is a result of the geometric optic perspective on what light is. We were starting to talk about geometric optics. We talked about the law of reflection. There's another phenomenon called refraction. So let's imagine that we have a medium here. Let's say it's glass. And we have an incident ray of light come in, and this will have an angle theta 1 with respect to the perpendicular. Okay? And now, if this was a silvered mirror, of course we'd have reflection, and it would be at some angle theta 1 prime, where theta 1 prime would equal theta 1. But that's not what we're interested in here. What we're interested in is what happens when this light goes into that glass. What does it do? All right? Now up here, this is air. Let's call it vacuum. So there's no density to the material up here. Okay? But down here, this is glass. This has a real density. I mean, it's a solid. So this light, we can go back to our wave idea. This wave has to sort of propagate through this material. And what actually happens, if you were to think of the little atoms in here, the light gets absorbed and then re-emitted, and absorbed by another atom and re-emitted. Okay? And this process slows the light down effectively. All right? So when we have light come into a material, okay, up here in a vacuum, the speed of light is c, 3 times 10 to the 8th meters per second. All right? But down here in glass, that's not what it's going to be. It'll have a smaller velocity because it's going through this material and it's constantly being absorbed and re-emitted and absorbed and re-emitted. Okay? Now, one thing to think about this issue of what does it mean to be transparent, it's transparent because it will re-emit it, meaning it will re-emit the light in roughly the same wavelengths that it absorbed it. And not all materials do that. And those are ones that just absorb it and then that's it. Or they heat up and then they re-emit it in a very different wavelength. So now there's a way to think about this. So this light's going to come in, and I'm going to draw a generic thing here. So let's say the light comes down in this direction. And with respect to the perpendicular, let's call this angle theta 2. Okay? Now, All right, there is a relationship between the angles and the velocities. I'll write it down, and then I'll try to give an idea using Huygens' principle how this happens. But for instance, this angle and this angle, they're not going to be equal. And the relationship between this one and this one has to do with the relative velocities. So first, the way that these two relate to each other is that the ratio of the sines is equal to the ratio of the velocities. Okay? Yes? That's a good question. So let me try to explain it. So when the light comes in, it slows down. Why would that cause a change in angle? Okay. Well, we're thinking about this from rays, and rays doesn't really allow us to see this very easily. But we can think about this in terms of waves. So let's imagine I have waves coming in with... These are the crests and trough, crest, trough, you know, so the wave is, you know, looking like that, okay? And it's coming in at some angle. Now, if I were to think about this in geometric optics, this would be a ray going in this direction, okay? So it would have some angle with respect to the vertical, the perpendicular, okay? But this is a wave, all right? Now, the thing is that when we get to this point, when we hit here, all right, this thing was traveling along at some unit in time. It was traveling some distance. In the same amount of time, it travels. So let's say that in some, this is a delta t. We travel this distance, okay? So all of the waves on this side of that interface travel that distance. But on this side, the distance traveled in a time delta t is, say, much smaller. Okay? So now what that means is this wave front, if there was no material here, that wave front would be here, but instead it's right here. Okay? And it's because of Huygens' principle. At every point here, it's like emitting a whole bunch of waves, and there's some discussion of this in the book. But what happens is, you could think about it from the point of view of travel of the peaks, for instance, and they slow down. So here, I have a peak at delta t after it crossed the interface. Well, at that same moment in time, okay, that would have corresponded to here. Well, there's going to be a peak at delta t here, and at all points, what's going to happen is at that same moment in time, this is where that wave front is going to be, that peak, okay? This thing. So what happens is this wave now looks like it's doing this. Does that make sense? Okay? The same thing happens over here. Same thing happens over here, etc. Well, now, okay, let's keep drawing it. Well, now what happens is the ray is always perpendicular to these things. Now, my ray is going like this. Okay? And so the angle that I would see for the light rays in geometric optics would look like it had become closer to the perpendicular. And it's because these rays hit the surface, you know, the stuff over here, This part of the wavefront hits this interface before this part of the wavefront. So it slows down sooner. And because it slows down sooner, it lags behind in terms of how far now it can go in this direction, in the direction it was originally moving. And if you follow that through for every point along here, what you find is that these wavefronts don't come at the same, you know, direction that they were. There actually is bent. Okay? So this is kind of using, it's a useful exercise, but this is trying to use the idea of Huygens' principle. Well, I haven't said it explicitly so much, but what I'm really doing is I'm saying, well, at this point, it's like this point is emitting waves, itself. And every point along here is emitting waves themselves. And that's why we end up getting these parallel, you know, peaks, but that are oriented differently than before. It has to do with the velocity. But you really don't come up with this conclusion unless you think about light as a wave. Okay? There's no physics in the geometric optic description. There's no understanding of what that is. It's just geometry. The thing moves in some direction until it hits something and whatever. The physics is that this material has a certain density, has certain electrical and magnetic properties, and so when light is incident on it, it is transmitted through that material in a certain way. That's the physics of it. Now, we can actually, this change here, we can actually quantify. So there's a way of understanding what the properties of these materials are. So this is the general geometric rule. Okay? But we can actually do the following. We can define for every material, okay, including glass, we can define a quantity called the index of refraction. And this is defined to be, we call it n, we use the parameter n, and it equals the speed of light in a vacuum, c, divided by the speed of light in that particular medium. Okay? And we can observe what v is. Actually, now we can calculate it. But, you know, let's take, for instance, in the case of water, n equals 1.3, meaning that the speed of light in water is basically 30% smaller than the speed of light in a vacuum. So the speed of light in a vacuum is 3 times 10 to the 8. Speed of light in water is a little over 2 times 10 to the 8th meters per second. Okay? So, but we can do that. We could say, okay, this is for, you know, glass is a substance we can get it for. That's around 1.3. We could do quartz is around 1.5. We can do diamonds, that's around 1.7. So each material that's transparent to light, we can come up with what that index of refraction is. And in fact, oftentimes there's tables of these things. If you're an engineer that's building something that needs to know what these are, a lot of like for instance in microscope and telescope design, there's a lot of work, very precise work in knowing exactly what these are, very exotic materials that are combinations of different things which have very specific indices of refraction, and that can be combined in such a way so as to get a very clear image. So there's a number that basically encapsulates the physics that's going on here for that particular material. As light goes in here, these electromagnetic interactions of the light with the atoms, that's physics. Okay, we can calculate those and test those, but for the engineering or application side of it, we don't care. We just need to know the net effect. The net effect is n. So all of the information about this goes into n. Okay? So if we could go back to our example. Here, I don't know if I should have done that, but we could go back to our example here, and, all right, we already drew the orientations of these things, okay? Now, there's something else that I've drawn here that maybe didn't occur to you, but at each of these points, something has changed. The velocity has changed, okay? So there's a velocity change right at this interface, okay? Now, we want to know something about we're going to want to rewrite this equation in some way that relates to the index of refraction. So I don't want to have to measure the speed of light in the two media on either side of this boundary every time I want to figure out the optical properties of that media. I want you to give me n, and then I can figure out what the angle of deflection will be, the angle of refraction. Well, we could think about this a little bit because we could say, well, here at this point, okay, let's call this side 1 and side 2. Well, we know that V2 is less than V1. You know, again, this is we're doing is glass, and this is vacuum. Okay? The frequency, 2, what is the relationship of that with respect to the frequency on the top? Okay? Well, we should think about this carefully. Right at this point here, as a function of time, on this side, just on this side of that point, the amplitude of the electric field of that light, of that electromagnetic wave, is going to be going up and down, you know, getting larger and smaller, okay? And it's going to be doing it with some frequency, F1, all right? Now, on just on this side of the interface, what's got to be happening? Well, let's think about what would happen if F2 was not equal to F1. That would mean that on just above that interface and going from just above it to just below it, there would be a discontinuity because the wave would be oscillating like this in one case and here it would be oscillating in a different case and they would be out of sync. There would be times when just on this side it was at a maximum when just on this side it was a minimum. Okay? And the problem is you'd get right at that point, that huge transition, you'd get a pileup of energy. You have an infinite transition in the intensity of light, but you get a pileup of energy, and you can't have that. That discontinuity can't happen. So this means that the frequencies have to be equal. Okay? Well, that's fine, but we also know that V equals lambda times frequency, okay? And so if these two things are true, then I can write down that the ratio of the wavelengths on either side of this boundary are equal to the ratio of the velocities. Okay? Can you not see that? Sorry. So, okay? And by the way, you can kind of see it just by the way I drew it. Here's a wavelength here. And here's a wavelength here. So this is lambda 2. This is lambda 1. It's pretty clear that lambda 2 is smaller than lambda 1, the way that I've drawn this. Okay? And that's what's being said here. So if velocity V2 is smaller than V1, then lambda 2 is going to be smaller than lambda 1 in just the exact ratio that you have here. Okay, now that's interesting because, well, I have the same ratio here as I have for my geometrical expression. Okay? So that means I can equate this thing to lambda 1 over lambda 2. Okay? All right. Now the other thing that I can do is I can use my definition of the index of refraction, and I can use that here to replace for V2 and V1. So what this is going to equal okay, So what I end up with here is that the velocity changes, the wavelength changes. The velocity change, this ratio, is reflected in this ratio of C over N, okay? And the C's cancel. I can rewrite this as N2 over N1, right? Now, be very careful here. This is 2 over 1. And wait a minute. Sorry. I changed my notation. Okay. So the geometrical description means that the change in the sine and the angle goes as the ratio of the velocities. If V2 is less than V1, then sine theta 2 will be less than sine theta 1. Then lambda 2 will be less than lambda 1. And I can write this down in terms of essentially using my definition of the index of refraction. I can simplify this by canceling the C's, and I get N1 over N2. The thing that I was trying to say was you should be very careful. These all have 2 over 1, 2 over 1, 2 over 1. This has 1 over 2. Okay? Yes?
Can you just write down real quick on the board what N is again?
N is this.
Oh, there it is. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay? And I can simplify this expression, okay, to basically get the following. So here, I've just used this piece and this piece. So now we've done what I said we wanted to do. I don't want to have to know what the wavelength of the light is in my medium. I don't want to have to know what the velocity is. I don't want to have to measure these things. I want you to give me a number, N, that's valid for this material. And then I'll pick whatever angle of incidence I want, theta 1, and I can calculate theta 2. Okay? So N1 or N2 is just a property of the material. And oftentimes, if I'm making something, if I'm making some optical device, I will just go to the CRC handbook or some other engineering style handbook, and I will look up quartz, and it will tell me what the index of refraction is. Okay, so this is Snell's law of refraction. Okay, and we had already done the law of reflection. So these are sort of the two laws that are telling us about the behavior of light with geometric optics. So now let's take problem 14. Okay, and I don't actually have it all written down, but basically, in problem 14, what happens is you have some light incident on some material here, and this is called crown glass, okay? And actually, this is going to be along the lines of the question. So crown glass actually is relatively dense, and it has an index of refraction of 1.52. Okay? So that's this medium. Now, outside of here, this piece of crown glass is inside sort of a bath of water. Okay? So N2 is 1.52. In the case of this, this is N1. This is now 1.33. Okay? So N1 is not 1.0. It's some value. The important point is that N1 and N2 are still not equal, and so there will be some refraction here. If these two were equal, light would just pass through pretty much unimpeded. There would be very little that you would notice. Now, the question is, well, I didn't write it down, but okay, I guess we could just go through. And we're given that this angle here is theta 2 is equal to 19.6 degrees. Okay? And then the question is, what is theta 1 and what is theta 1 prime? So theta 1, well, we can use to get the first part, theta 1, we just use Snell's law. N1 sine theta 1 equals N2 sine theta 2. Okay? And then I want to know theta 1, so I can rewrite this as the arcsine of N2 over N1 times sine theta 2. Okay? And does anybody want to calculate that for me? What is it? 22.5? Okay, that's fine. Okay? So what's theta 1 prime? 22.1. So theta prime, to figure out theta 1 prime, we use the law of reflection, that the angle of incidence equals the angle of reflection. So theta 1 prime equals the same 22.5 degrees. Okay? Thanks. So that's how you could use these laws of reflection. I want to know where the light's going. You'll notice that I've got this interface, some of the light does get reflected. You see this. I mean, if you've got a window and you're looking at it at certain angles, you'll see light reflected off of it, even though light's also being transmitted through it. Okay? So you can simultaneously have refraction and reflection at that interface. Okay, so now let's just talk briefly again. I'll just bring your attention to it, but it's good to read section 35.6. I guess I kind of did this a little bit out of order. But 35.6 describes Huygens' principle, which is basically saying that every point, if I've got light moving through some area, then every point here acts as if it is a generator of waves. Okay? And what ends up happening if I do that with all of these points, and this is going to be a catastrophic drawing, but what ends up happening is the wavefronts all, you know, there's a place where they all sort of constructively interfere. Okay, meaning they all add up. And the more points I add, if I did one here, I would get, you know, I would just start getting what would look like a wave front. Okay? And so in the Huygens principle case, by thinking about light as this wave-like phenomena, then what happens is every point in the wave becomes a source of waves. The only reason that I get a unit wave over many of this is that where they all add up, I get a peak, and where they all cancel, I get a trough and a peak and a trough, and it's because of all these little wavelets that are adding up, okay? And it's that this idea, which is how I was trying to describe earlier, the reason that the velocity changes, because you get this wave front that then changes orientation because part of it slows down before you're done. Okay? Then the next thing I wanted to talk about was dispersion and prisms. So in the case of what we've been talking about is a situation where we have one interface from material 1 to material 2, and then that's it. Okay? And if we stay there just for a moment, what's true, now let me do this. So now let's say I have some light coming in here, right? Now let's say this is white light. Now white light has all of the different wavelengths in the visible spectrum. Our eyes, our brain calls that white, but it's just blue, red, green, everything added together. Everything is combined. Okay? So that means I've got some red and I've got some blue with a smaller wavelength all propagating here. And so now let's say that's in a vacuum, and now I have this medium here with an index of refraction n. All right? And what's going to happen, so here's my perpendicular. I'm going to get a refraction of that light so that it's closer to the perpendicular. Okay? That's what we just saw. It turns out, though, that usually for materials, n is actually a function of the wavelength of the incident light. And it depends on the material, but if you were to plot n versus wavelength, so wavelength gets bigger going to the right, usually you'll get something that decreases. So when you have shorter wavelengths, so this might be blue light, you have a higher index of refraction than if you have red light, which would be a longer wavelength. Okay? So that means that what's going to happen is that the... Okay, so let's look at the simplified version of Snell's law. Let me make sure that I don't confuse you. I already did. So if we, you know, we're going from vacuum to here, that's sort of the simplified version of Snell's law, where we just have a medium here with index of refraction n. And so what's going to happen here is that if n is larger for blue light, that means that the change in angle, this ratio, sine theta 1 over sine theta 2, is going to be bigger. Meaning that for blue light, I'm going to get a bigger angle of deflection. Okay? So theta 2 here for blue, and then if I were to do red, I'm going to get a small... Now, I'm exaggerating this a lot. This is usually a fairly small effect. But what's going to happen is I'm going to get a larger angle of refraction from the blue light than I'm going to get from the red light. Okay? If I want to exaggerate this, then I can make a prism where I have, this is index of refraction n, call it n2 equals one, you know, some value, and then out here is n equals 1. So if I have light here, it will get refracted, and then here I will have another refraction. And if I, now I have to think carefully about the orientation here so that I continue to exaggerate the change, because here I'm going now from the higher index of refraction to the lower index of refraction. Okay? So I want, if this is the blue, now I want the blue to be refracted still more. So I have to use Snell's law to think about this, because now the perpendicular is, say, right here for this blue ray. Okay? And so I'm going to get a bigger angle away from the perpendicular for the blue light because I'm going to the less dense material. But what ends up happening here is we see red and blue. And that's what you, and so you see a spectrum, you know, basically between these. And that's what happens when you have a prism. Okay? So it's taking white light, and because the material that the prism is made of, it may be glass, it may be quartz, but because it has some dependence of the index of refraction on the wavelength of the light, that means that I'm going to get some dispersion, and then I can do my prism in such a way to exaggerate that, and I will get a little spectrum. Okay? All right? So, now, yeah. Okay? And actually, with a rainbow, this is basically what we're seeing. It's a little more complicated, but basically you have, you know, raindrops, and you have light from the sun that's passing into these and being refracted and then coming back out of them, and you're seeing them. This is my really classy artistic ability. But you're seeing them, and what you end up seeing is that, you know, for instance, the blue light may be, for this particular drop, may be refracted to come to your eyes, but the red light may not. So from that particular region of the sky, you see blue light. A little lower down, I've got a raindrop here. Now the red light gets to me, and the blue light doesn't get to me. And so from that region of the sky, now I see red. And that's why we see a rainbow, okay? But it's basically the raindrops that are in the sky are just acting a little bit like little prisms. The last thing is what's called, well, I won't even name it. I'll just tell you what's happening. So let's reverse it. We are thinking that we're going from the less dense material to the denser material, and we get this refraction. But let's say now we're in medium 2. This has index of refraction 2. And let's say that I have some light passing towards some boundary. This is index of refraction 1. And N1 is, as before, less than N2. Okay? So now we got the opposite thing going. Okay? All right, well, to some extent, this should look just like the reverse of the drawing that we had, meaning that it obeys. So this is theta 2, and there will be some angle here, theta 1, okay? And Snell's law governs the, you know, how big the angles are with respect to each other, okay? However, what you see is that angle 1 is a larger angle with respect to the vertical than angle 2. So what does that mean? Well, let's say that I came in like this. All right? Now I'm going to get a very shallow angle, theta 1. Okay? Let's say I came in even more shallow. There is an angle I can pick where theta 1 would be exactly along the interface, meaning that theta 1 equals 90 degrees, okay? So the light doesn't quite get out of the material, okay? If I hit this at a smaller angle still, then what's going to happen is a reflection. The light's not going to make it out of N2. It's going to hit this interface, and the index of refraction is such that the angle of refraction is greater than 90 degrees. It's just going to pass. Well, once it hits 90 degrees, then refraction stops happening. Basically, it can't be refracted out of the material, and so all of the energy involved in that light is reflected at that surface. Okay? This is called total internal reflection. Okay? And we can actually figure out what is the theta 2 that corresponds to this. We can use Snell's law. So in the case of Snell's law, we want to know what is the theta 2 that would give me, that would be the value, any angle theta 2 larger than this will be reflected internally. So what I can do is I can rename theta 2 to theta c, call it theta critical, and we'll say sine theta c equals n1 over n2 sine theta 1. Okay? Now the sine, what's the sine of 90 degrees? 1. Okay? So this becomes 1. So this, the theta critical becomes just the ratio of the indices of refraction in these two cases. Okay? You've got to remember here that n1 is less than n2. This doesn't tell you anything if the opposite is true. Then you don't have total internal reflection. Okay? But theta critical being the value of theta c at which internal reflection starts, that is the relationship that tells you how to calculate that. Well, this light better. But so to keep this light in, what you can do is you can create a what's called a cladding. And so this is a material. So let's call this N0 and this N2. This material has an index of refraction somewhere in between those two. And so this first one gets me a certain angle of refraction. It comes out, but now when this hits this boundary, it's internally reflected. And so if you some fibers have many, many clads, many, many layers to keep the light in, because these fibers will be going on miles, and these angles usually have to be fairly small. Okay? So that is, I mean, so that's sort of the fiber optic, what's happening there. Now, this is actually used in a lot of different ways. And one way that it's used in particle physics, for instance, is that, which again is something that we do here, if I have a fundamental particle, a pion or some other electron, that particle, we can build a detector where it passes by some fiber, and we can put some material in here that when a charged particle goes by, light gets emitted by the material inside that fiber. Okay? That's called scintillation. Okay? But what ends up happening is, once this light's produced, I have a fiber here, and I want to use this fiber now to propagate that all the way out to some digitizing electronics where I can read out, and I can say, an electron went through this fiber, but it didn't go through this fiber, so I know where that electron went. It's a way for me to identify where the path of a particle is. So this is one way that we use them. We use them in telecommunications. Another place that gets used is actually in medicine. So I don't know if people have heard of a cardiac catheterization. You heard of this procedure? Okay. Control the fibers. You can actually have light propagated from some place out, and you can image whatever you're looking at. So people can look at blockages, all kinds of different things in the heart, and see what's going on. There's no surgery involved. And it's a very powerful tool that people use. So